right now there's nothing officially on the books for SAT. Let me drop it. So, although that seemed like the main thing that happened during the week Tuesday of this week, it was in the afternoon, I watched a launch from Kazakhstan. The Russians sent up another crew on a Soyuz spacecraft. This time, one Russian, he's the commander, and two other people, and they were both NASA astronauts, which is kind of unusual. Usually they have one Russian, one American, and one European Space Agency astronaut. But this time, two Americans. So I thought that was interesting. And Mark Vanderhei, he was actually supposed to go up a year or so ago, but they switched him with another fellow, Jack Fisher. So he finally got a chance. It's his first flight to go up. And Joe Acaba, it's his third flight up. So two Americans and then the one Russian was Alexander Mikorkin, I think it's pronounced. And he's the Russian commander. And they joined three other fellows that were also up on the International Space Station. So now that they have a complete group up there, that's the normal number, six. They want to keep it like that until eventually we start launching people from Florida here in the United States. And then eventually we'll have a total of seven people on station permanently. But that's not going to happen for a while. The first crewed vehicle without a crew going up in February, the earliest February of next year, so what, 5-6 months from now, they should have tested this thing out. That's going to be launched by SpaceX. Dragon crew vehicle will be unmanned. It'll go up from Launch Complex 39A, where they've been launching all their flights lately, Florida, and that's designed to launch people. And they have a regular tower built for bringing people up that will be utilized after this first flight. First flight is a proof of concept, I guess, if they want to send it up to the International Space Station, have it dock autonomously, with nobody doing anything. It'll be done by itself, and eventually undock, and then come back and land in the Pacific Ocean. And once they do that, they'll be ready to send a crew up. So I would imagine that would be a couple of months at least later, and that would be one NASA astronaut and one astronaut from commercial world from SpaceX. And then once they can do it with a crew, NASA will eventually approve them to start, regular rotation of people to the International Space Station. They'll be carrying up four people on a regular basis. Instead of what Soyuz does, the Russians launch three at a time. So that should be very good, probably by the end of the year. And not to be outdone, Boeing also has their own spacecraft called the Starliner, and they'll be doing the same thing. They'll be launching four people to the space station at a time once they get up and running with the Starliner, but they're lagging behind SpaceX probably by a couple of months. So much for that. Now, 2 weeks ago, I didn't talk about very, very little anyway. Last week, SpaceX launched the X-37B to low Earth orbit. 37B is really a space plane. Kind of looks like a small shuttle. And it's really by the Air Force, and it's really a top secret thing. So after it goes up, you don't even know what orbit it's going into. They don't have cameras. Usually when SpaceX launches a rocket, you'll watch this thing live. And they'll have a camera following the second stage all the way to when they deploy the payload, whatever it might be. They'd be launched, sometimes they'll launch 10 satellites at a time. You'll watch one go off right after the other. But in this case, after it went up, there was no more camera for the second stage. But the cameras were still on for the first stage, because they wound up bringing the first stage booster back to Cape Canaveral. They brought it back to landing zone one, where they launched, where they landed boosters before. This is the seventh booster that they've landed on land. I think it was a total of 16. Seven landed on land, and the rest all landed at sea, either in the Atlantic Ocean or in the Pacific Ocean. They've landed on these autonomous drone ships that SpaceX owns. As big as a football field that comes down with, out of the sky, with these fins guiding it all the way down to the boat, and then the four legs open up on the very bottom. Each leg is like 30 feet long, and it lands on the deck, and off it goes back to Florida, standing up. They don't lay it down. It comes back all the way standing up. They eventually take a crane, 24 hours later, and after it comes back, and they're able to reuse these things now to save money. So that's pretty much it. There's more things, Dick, but we'll hold it at that. Back to that. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Do I have anybody with any questions for Paul during the space report? Give us your call letters and name right now.
KC1SAM, Sam, for the question.
KC1SAM, Sierra Alpha Mike. I think you said your name is Sam. Go right ahead, Sam.
Roger, it is Sam. Paul, would it be dangerous for them to park to see me in an orbit and let it circle so that sometime in a very distant future could be brought back and put in a museum somewhere?
Okay, Dick, do I have it?
You sure do, Paul?
Yeah, the cost, the practicality of trying to, actually the physics behind bringing something all the way back to Saturn would be prohibitive. You'd have to send a rocket probably as big as, a Saturn V rocket, the whole rocket, all the way to Saturn to try to get a hold of this thing and bring it back. And even if you did bring it back, it does weigh about 5,000 pounds. It's as big as a school bus, they said. So it's large. You would then have to have like a shuttle capability to be able to put it into the back of a cargo bay of some sort and fly that back and land it. To do that would probably cost billions and billions of dollars to do something like that. And it's not easy to get something back from these outer planets. So, someday they'll be able to do it. They'll have these ion engines, probably multiple ion engines and more efficient than what we have now. They take forever to get up to speed. They're not like chemical engines. Eventually it works. For instance, they have another, NASA has a planned mission called Lucy, L-U-C-Y, and that's going to be going out to near Jupiter, in front of Jupiter, and then eventually behind Jupiter, and then it's all going to be done with ion engines, small spacecraft,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
One end to the other. It's going to go from here. There's an L5 and an L4 location way in front of Jupiter and way behind Jupiter, and there's these asteroids there, so this Lucy's going to look at that. So I guess I could envision someday maybe Lucy coming past Earth. We drop it. But when it does, it'll be coming by at such a speed, never be able to slow the thing down and get it into orbit. But if you could, I guess at that point you could take a shuttle, which we don't use anymore, and go up there with a cargo bay and grab this, probably only maybe a 2,000-pound thing and bring it back. So, the same thing with Galileo. That thing was in orbit around Jupiter, and they deorbited that right into the atmosphere. They just burn it up. Fuel that it would take to bring something back just to get it out of orbit from Saturn would be a tremendous amount of fuel to deorbit that thing. Back to you, Dick. WSY.
Yes, Sam, you've used some good common sense. Most recently, a number of proposals have been written by people who are a little bit naive, saying we've got a whole lot of nuclear waste. Why don't we just drop it into the sun, all this nuclear waste that we've got to store for a zillion years? And what you don't realize is that the Earth is in orbit around the sun. We're 93 million miles from the sun. That's the radius of orbit. 186 million miles is the diameter of our orbit. In order for the Earth to be in orbit around the sun, the Earth is moving along its orbital path at 19 miles per second. I don't know what that is in thousands of miles an hour. I'm guessing it's around 30,000 miles an hour. So to drop something into the sun, you have to first stop it from moving at that velocity in this orbit. You have to give it enough thrust to stop it from moving at 40,000 miles an hour. And then, yes, if you could do that, then it would drop straight toward the sun by the sun's gravity. And by the way, you also have to use a whole lot of energy to get the stuff off of the Earth into low Earth orbit. You have to launch it off the Earth, get it moving at 17,500 miles an hour just to get it into low Earth orbit. So dropping something into the sun takes a lot of energy, even though you think it's downhill and it's easy. So by the same token, all that rocket power, all that rocket power and all those Mars and Jupiter flybys that you did for gravity assist, in order to get Cassini out there to Saturn, you have to do all of that energy development in reverse to get it to come back. You know how big that rocket was that got it there? Need something about that big in order to bring it back. Ain't easy. So, it's not obvious until you start getting into the specifics. KC1 SAM, K2LIW, good, Sam.
Yeah, Roger, Dick. I wasn't thinking of doing it next week. I'm thinking in the very distant future, we'll look at that and say, I couldn't even say guess as to how far in the future, 200 years. It might be a simple thing by then. I just thought because of its historical significance and how we have many things in the Air and Space Museum in Washington that we look back upon and, you know, bore at and so forth. I was just wondering if that was something that would be possible. But you're right, it takes just as much energy, if not more, to bring it in as it would to put it out there. Answer my question. Back to you, KC1SAM.
And along these lines, one of the space puzzles that I've given to some of my friends is make believe that the SAM launching company, a very respected firm, launched a particular payload into space, got it into a beautiful equatorial orbit. And after the orbit was established and everybody opened the champagne bottles and celebrated, they suddenly realized, whoa, we made a mistake. We launched that into an equatorial orbit. The original contract was to launch it into a polar orbit. So somebody said, well, we'll just use the onboard reaction control jets and steer it toward a polar orbit instead of an equatorial orbit. Well, in order to get something into a polar orbit when it's already in equatorial orbit, you have to take every bit of that equatorial velocity, 17,500 miles an hour, going from west to east. You have to completely cancel that and then reestablish another 17,500 miles an hour north and south. So the amount of booster power it took you to get it into equatorial orbit you have to use twice that amount of booster power in order to get it into a polar orbit. One unit of booster power to stop it from moving in the equatorial direction, another unit of booster power to get it moving into the north-south direction to be in polar orbit. So if somebody made that mistake in launching into an equatorial orbit instead of a polar orbit, let me drop it. It would take twice as much booster energy to correct it. You're much better off to sell that satellite to somebody who wants an equatorial orbit and build another one. By the same token, the amount of dollars would be required to send a booster out there to Saturn in order to bring Cassini back home, it probably is more dollars than what Cassini is worth. You're better off building another Cassini rather than send something out there to bring it back. That's a rough guess on my part. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, I know. We've had that discussion before. Just to go a couple of degrees, change of inclination is a big deal. The shuttle, when it was up, the most it could change in flight was 3 degrees inclination. So whatever they put it into, they were hoping that they'd be within 3 degrees. And they always hope less than that because they don't want to use much fuel. You always like to have a lot of reserve. If you run out of fuel, it's time to come home. I know what Sam's thinking. You know, sure, you wait 200 years, 300 years, whatever it takes. But during that time frame, they don't want to take a chance of this thing running without fuel. The hydrazine fuel that they have on board Cassini was almost gone. Originally, they planned, for a 4 or 5 year mission, whatever, and they keep getting extensions by 2 years, 2 years. So, they've really got a lot of mileage out of Cassini. Anytime they wanted to change orbit or inclination a little bit, they would use very little fuel, but they would angle themselves near the moon tight, and tight would always give them little gravity assist or the acceleration, whatever they were looking for, or changing their angle slightly to do something different. And that's eventually how they made the final plunge, final orbit to end that mission. We drop it. So now take the one step further. We always talk about the James Webb Space Telescope. Now that's going to go out to 1 million miles away from Earth, orbiting the Sun, just like Earth is orbiting the Sun. So it's going to stay out there 1 million miles away instead of, orbiting the Earth like the Hubble. Now that's about, 4 times the distance of the Moon. And there's no way, I know we've talked about this before, no way to go out there and service that thing. Hubble, they've done it 5 different times. Sent the crew out, orbiting Earth, put in new computers, put in new gyroscope systems, batteries, even solar panels. No problem. You're able to do that. Put out 1 million miles out. Let me drop it. For the James Webb Space Telescope, they're making sure that this thing does not need to be serviced ever. Because send a crew, a spacecraft, all that energy out to 1 million miles out, and then have them turn around eventually after servicing this thing and trying to come back, you would need a tremendous amount of chemical power to do that. And ion power would be too slow. It would take too long before you can get up any kind of speed, the amount of time it would take for a human being to get back. But just like the way Sam's thinking, NASA people in Jet Propulsion Laboratory, they're thinking ahead. Somewhere in the future, maybe they will have a craft that goes out there. Maybe it'll be robotic. Maybe it will be manned, with all these private companies coming up. But somebody had enough foresight, and they attached the docking ring to the James Webb Space Telescope. Let me drop it. Not to bring back and put in the Smithsonian, but, as a way to eventually maybe servicing that thing. No plans of doing it right now, but you never know. You know, maybe Elon Musk will build his interplanetary transport, he calls it the ITS. Maybe he'll be able to have enough fuel in that thing to get out to the James Webb Space Telescope, have somebody service it, and, you know, change the solar panel or fix something and come on back. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
When it comes to the James Webb Space Telescope, for the last couple of months, they've moved it into Houston, where they've got a huge vacuum testing chamber, where they brought it down to a cryogenic temperature, and they're going to test it for a couple of months. But Houston was hit with a great big hurricane, and to run that chamber requires megawatts of power, and an awful lot of Texas lost power. So have we heard any words about the testing of James Webb at Houston and the difficulty of the hurricane? Has there been any interruption? I mean, the standby power they've got at Houston can run safety equipment, but can it really run that chamber? I'll bet you that chamber requires megawatts of power to run it, Paul. Have we heard any words along those lines? Along those lines, WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, well, all I heard was all the NASA facilities down in Houston stayed open and operating. Some of the buildings, which normally accept visitors, of course, were all shut down. So, I mean, you know, for instance, the mission control is located there for the International Space Station. They stayed in constant control, constant communication. They didn't lose a beat with all the science that goes on and communicating with the International Space Station. No problem. Two of the people that came back was Jack Fisher and Peggy Whitson right after Hurricane Irma hit, you know, a few days after that. And it must have been weird for them because they could look down at Houston when they did go overhead and see this massive hurricane over their place, but yet they never lost a beat talking to them. Communications most of it goes through White Sands and up to the Tedra satellites, the tracking data relay satellites. And back to the International Space Station. And they had continuous operations. From what I understand, nothing really was changed. They had some minor damage, wind damage in Cape Canaveral. Last year they had much more damage with Hurricane Matthew when that went through. So, it looks like they're okay. Some roof was ripped off of apparently a minor building, part of a roof down in Cape Canaveral. So they had some minor problems. By the way, Dick, I remember Earth going around the moon, sun, it was 66,000 miles per hour, I think was the number. But that's the number you were looking for before.
Yes, it is, and I think that's very close to 19 miles per second. 19 miles per second and 66,000 miles an hour. I think that's the approximate speed of the Earth going around the sun. Now, Paul, go ahead.
I remember that years ago in one of my books, and that stuck in my head. The miles per hour, I didn't memorize this. You know, I'd have to do the math for what it is per second. But, 66, I think, is the number, which is amazing because, you know, some of these meteorites come in and hit us, they're hitting us at like 40,000 miles per hour. And it's not like they're hitting us. We're really going into them. We're running into them. So it's the speed of the Earth. Mostly that's making these little pieces of dust and sand light up as meteorites. I'm going to say something else. Oh, I know what it was. Last week we were discussing the RTGs, the radio isotope thermoelectric generators. And you said, was there any spacecraft that ever went out with more than three? So I looked it up. Let me drop it. and Pioneer 10 and 11 had four RTGs on them. So two on one truss segment going out, and two on another truss segment. So how about that? There were two of them that did that. Back to six.
I wonder what it was about those spacecraft that required so much power that Voyager only needed three. So, what do you think required so much power, Eric? I mean, Paul, go ahead.
I think because they had more of a demand, the electronics in 1965, it was already a big difference between the demand on what you could do. You know, for, let's say, with 100 watts in 1965 when this thing was launched, compared to, say, 1977 when Voyager was launched. So I don't think you required that amount of power. Probably something along those lines. Either that or the RTGs weren't putting out as much as they were in 1977. Probably something like that. But no, I don't know those details.
Paul, recently we've been reading that the Stirling engine reversion of a radioactive thermal generator, or TG, has either two or three times higher efficiency. You get a lot more power output with the Stirling engine. And that was proposed that they were going to build the Stirling engine version. And the last I heard, they canceled that proposal. I wonder why. It's because they're worried about the reliability of something that has to mechanically move. The Stirling engine that was going to go on the RTG is not a piston and crankshaft. It was a double Stirling where the piston moves back and forth, and the piston itself is a neodymium magnet moving inside of a coil. So as the piston moves, it generates voltage in that coil by Faraday's law. Except for the fact that it's got some mechanical characteristics to it, which maybe they're worried that it's going to wear out. The fact that you can get two or three times the efficiency sounds awfully desirable. So I wonder if they ever announced the reason why they canceled that proposal. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, they wanted to put it on the next deep space mission. And right now they don't have any plan except for Europa Clipper, and they don't feel that technology is developed far enough to make a change. The Clipper is already designed to have the standard RTGs, so that's what I read on that. It's not going to have solar panels like Juno does. Juno has this big, massive solar panel, 120 feet long, generating enough power for that, for right, you know. So I would think maybe down the road a piece, you're going to have a mission that, maybe they'll request something like that, and that'll give them more time. I'm sure maybe it's not perfected yet, that might be it too. So I'm sure they're still trying to develop it. Funding is cut, in other words, you're saying, Nobody on the NASA budget is working on this anymore?
That is the impression I have, Paul, that it was a proposed technique because it's got a lot more efficiency. Therefore, you would think somebody would start working on it to give it the full development and history so that we know its reliability. But right now, I don't think anybody is following through with that development. And maybe it's because they're afraid of something that requires mechanical motion. In order for that Stirling engine to move back and forth, in the weightlessness of space, you can have a piston move back and forth inside of a cylinder, and maybe the piston doesn't touch the cylinder. It's being suspended magnetically. But still, there's got to be valves opening and closing somewhere. So it does require mechanical motion. And the nice thing about the current RTG is that those thermocouples just sit there absorbing the heat difference between the hot side and the cold side, and slightly inefficiently developing electricity. No mechanical moving parts. And they do slowly degrade in time. And I wonder, is that degradation because the polonium source plutonium source starts giving out less heat, or is it because the thermocouples themselves degrade in some way? But the Stirling engine, if it had light predicted lifetime at 2 or 3 times the efficiency, it sounds awfully desirable and worth pursuing. WS2N, K2LAW.
I remember changing out little thermocouples for gas units years ago. Thermocouple itself would go, and the wire was fine, you know, it was, but the dissimilar metals would eventually go. And next thing you know, somebody's gas burner won't turn on. But it's unscrewed out from the gas valve and stick it back in, and stick a little thermocouple bulb in back in the pilot is they used to go, so I guess, you know, that's essentially what happens. I know that happened to, you know what happened to one of the Pioneer spacecraft? There was Pioneer 10, then there was other ones. There was Pioneer 5, 6, 7. Pioneer 6 was a solar panel, and that surrounded the body of it, and that kept running like forever. They eventually made contact with it. It was still 35 years in operation. But the ones with the RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, like Pioneer 10 and 11, eventually stopped working, and didn't hear from it again. One of them, I think, was Pioneer 10. They had traveling wave tubes on them. There were two on, you know, there was a redundant system. So there was two on each spacecraft, and one of them eventually failed. They sent the command, or it was automatically done. I'm not sure if it was an autonomous operation or if they sent the command, but eventually it switched over to traveling wave to number two, and it went back into operation. But I mean, they were only lasted so long, but they're going outside the solar system too, just like Voyager's. Just that Voyager's bypassed them, so they were sent, you know, 12 years later. Not 12 years later, but probably, 68, I think, 67 they were launched, something like that. Say 10 years later, back either.
So the first two spacecraft capable of going beyond Pluto, I think our Voyager 1 and 2, Pioneer 1 and 2, well, two Pioneers, I'm not sure of their numbers.
And 11.
Okay, Pioneer 10 and 11 are the first two spacecraft that went beyond the distance to Pluto, is what I think is you're saying, Paul. But Voyager 1 and 2 launched later, but because of all the space flybys, they ended up with the planetary flybys and gravity boost. They ended up at a higher velocity, so therefore they're considerably further out than Pioneer 10 and 11. Is that true?
Yeah, they caught up to them, I think, in the 90s, late 1990s. Caught up and passed them. You know, the Voyagers are going, like, I don't know, 40,000 miles per hour, and the Pioneers are less than that. By the time New Horizon gets out that far, it'll be around 8,000 miles less. So nobody's going to catch the Voyagers. And they had all those gravity assists. They passed all those planets. You know, Voyagers, you know, really, I mean, well, so one of them, Voyager 1, you know, eventually you got Jupiter's gravity assist, and then Saturn, and then eventually the moon Titan sent that thing above the ecliptic planes. But the other one, Voyager 2, that one kept on going. I mean, eventually it went to Uranus, got a gravity assist on that. Then Neptune didn't get much on that. They wanted to take as many pictures as they can. I think they went on the opposite side of the planet or something like that. They wanted to get pictures of Triton, which they were very surprised when they saw that. It was an active moon. They found out that it had nitrogen coming out of the surface of the moon. So they were glad they did whatever they did with Voyager 2. back to you, sir.
Are there any other spacecraft leaving the solar system other than Pioneer 10 and 11, Voyager 1 and 2, and New Horizons? So we got a total of 5 spacecraft capable of leaving the solar system and getting into outer space. Now, I don't think any of the proposed future launches are going to be leaving the solar system. You're going to correct me on that one. Also, on Voyager 1 and 2, you've got this record, gold-plated record, screwed down to the side of the spacecraft with hello in 51 languages and pictures and whatever, a lot of information about where the spacecraft came from. I don't think Pioneer 10 and 11 had that kind of information on board. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Then along put the plaque, you know, you had that man and woman figure, and then you had next to them a point of where we originated from, where the spacecraft came from, and it was based on pulsars. It was surrounded by, you know, a bunch of lines going to the central point, and a bunch of pulsars, so any spacefaring nation would be able to figure out where this thing came from based on the pulsars. And then that gave the direction and location of the star, our star, sun. And then they had more detailed pictures of our sun, Mercury, Venus, and then Earth. And then a little spacecraft with an arrow pointing to the third planet. And then it had the other planets. It had a picture of Saturn with the rings around it. You know, who knows, a billion years from now, you know, that might not have rings, but, you know, that's what they had. And so you do have pictures or a plaque on 10 and 11. You have the gold-plated record on Voyager 1 and 2. I'll have to find out what New Horizon has. We have a disc with everybody's name. You could have put your name on there before that thing went up. Back to you.
Yeah, I do remember now the picture of the man and woman, and the man is waving, as I remember, with his hand up in the air, a greeting, and there was a lot of unhappiness about the fact that these two figures on Pioneer 10 and 11 are unclothed, and there's missing details on the female body that the NASA people thought that the critics were being overly conservative. So we are indicating where it came from. We're giving out our address. And you worried about the fact that Saturn's rings may not be there a million years from now. I think Cassini discovered that Saturn's rings are a hell of a lot more stable. We used to think that the rings around Saturn is a temporary condition and they're all going to go away. And I think Cassini has gathered raw data saying that those rings are going to be there for a tremendous amount of time. And we discovered that Jupiter has a ring. I think Uranus and Neptune have a ring. So all of the outer planets have got a ring. Maybe Pluto doesn't. Though maybe Pluto does. So those rings are a lot more stable, we now know. However, when it comes to the pulsars, pulsars are slowly changing in their pulsing rate. A million years from now, will you still, let me drop. A million years from now, will they be able to figure out where we came from as many of those pulsars change their rate slowly? So, let me hear your details, your recollection on them. I think Cassini has discovered enough raw data to say that the rings around Saturn are going to be there for a long time. They're a lot more stable. Yeah, individual little planets are shepherding those rings and keeping them stable. And you know about those propellers. Some of the rings have a little bitty satellite that generates this effect that they call the propeller effect. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I saw that on one of the documentaries. And watched it. There were two documentaries. Nova had one, and the Science Channel had one. And because of the recording that that I made on Channel 13. I was too happy with that. I used the DVR for that, and every 4 minutes, I was looking at the clock, just every 4 minutes you would lose the sound, the picture would go completely black, couldn't see nothing, and then it would come back, you know, a second or two later. Well, they would be telling you, you know, the rings are going to last for, and then 2 seconds later, you know, they're talking about, you know, something else. So I wasn't happy with that. And then the recording of Science Channel came out perfect. And I actually like that one better. Usually Novert does a better job, but the Science Channel really did a good job. Fantastic job. And they had a lot more information from Carolyn Porco. She's the visual scientist. For all the pictures, a lot of the pictures that were taken, 400,000 pictures over 13 years. Well, you know, that's like what a tremendous amount of pictures. She was responsible for that. She was very good in explaining that. She's been with the mission from day one. So that was pretty good. And they did have her on Channel 13, but not that much. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Carolyn Porco is a, what now, picture expert is not the right word, but the visual techniques engineer. Certainly on Cassini, and I think she's even been associated with a number of other spacecraft that are giving visual feedback. Does that sound reasonable, Paul? K2IW?
I would imagine probably early on with the Galileo mission, I would suspect. But Saturn was her baby. She comes out of New York, you know, you don't get anything better than that. We had a lot of New York people involved with the space program. Carl Sagan, when he came out of the Brooklyn, Alan Porco from the Bronx. Now we even have Neil deGrasse Tyson. So, and there's probably a million more that I can't think of right now. Back to you, Dick.
I'm pretty sure that a couple of the astronauts went to Long Island schools for their high school training.
Yeah, Mike Massimino, he spokesman once in a while for a show called The Planets on the Science Channel. And we've had some others, Ellen Collins from upstate New York, was the first woman commander on a space shuttle. We've had a bunch. Back to you.
So when it comes to future spacecraft, I'd like to believe there's some plans in the early planning stage right now for visiting maybe Europa and digging down through the ice and looking at the fluids underneath. I think there's going to be a spacecraft that's going to do a better job of monitoring the geysers coming out of some of these moons of Jupiter and Saturn, because they very well contain, quite possibly contain organic materials. So, what do you know about spacecraft being planned right now to visit either the moons of Jupiter or the moons of Saturn, or any other outer planet missions, you know, missions beyond Mars? We've got a ridiculous number of spacecraft we have sent to Mars, but, despite the fact there are people who think they want to go there and colonize it. Forget what I read. I think the average temperature on Mars is something like -155 degrees Celsius. That's a ridiculously cold average temperature. The amount of power required to keep you from freezing in that environment is going to be extremely high. I don't see how you can colonize Mars, Paul. You can't live in something that cold with no atmosphere. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, even if it was a sunny day, I'm not a vegetarian, so I would need to see a Burger King sign before I went. But future missions to Jupiter have the NASA Europa Clipper. That's been approved. They're working on that. Let me drop it. That should be interesting. They'd like to get it there quicker too, and instead of this, you know, 5-year mission, you know, it normally would take to get to Jupiter. They could do it in 3 years if they use the SLS, the Space Launch System that the NASA is developing, really for manned flight. But there's a lot of people that would like to use it for robotic missions as well. The same holds true for a mission to Uranus. They'd like to do that. And also Neptune. So these are future missions that scientists are pushing that are involved with NASA. But the only one fund that I know is Europa Clipper. And, of course, I mentioned Lucy before. That's supposed to go as well. Lucy's the one that's going to visit the Trojan asteroids, two sets of them. There's one at L4 and one at L5 in the Jupiter system. So ahead of Jupiter, you draw equilateral triangle between Sun, asteroids, Trojan asteroids, and Jupiter. You come to the L4 location, and then behind it would be the L5 location, Lagrange point 5. So this Lucy mission will go out to Jupiter as a gravity assist. Let me drop it.
QJRS.
Repeater, timeout.
Another station, and then go out to the asteroids, and then eventually with ionic engines come back past Earth and go back to the, you know, from the L4 to the L5 or the L5 to the L4, investigate these Trojan asteroids. I had another station, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, who is that station? Please give us your call letters and your name. Go right ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. It's Roger, Kilo 2, Juliet, Alpha, Sierra. And, Dick, I wanted to let you know that according to an entry here, Climate of Mars, they talk about a common average surface temperature of minus 55 Celsius or minus 67 degrees Fahrenheit. And they say surface temperatures may reach a high of about 20 Celsius, which is 68 Fahrenheit, and at noon at the equator, and a low of minus 153 Celsius, which is minus 243 degrees Fahrenheit at the poles. Not likely we're going to spend any time there. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if you had the opportunity, Roger, would you volunteer to be a pioneer on Mars?
I would volunteer somebody else. Can I take to mention my name?
Yep. And there was in the last year or so a proposal where some very high-performance students on Long Island were volunteering for what they thought was going to be a mission to Mars. The amount of solar radiation you're going to be exposed to in that trip between Earth and Mars, the chances of getting there in good health, very poor, and the chances of getting back home in good health are even poorer. And while you're there, it's going to be very unpleasant. When you read any of the finer details of what the Apollo astronauts put up with during each of those lunar missions, their knuckles inside of that glove was ripping up their nails and skinning their knuckles because of the air pressure on the inside of the suit wants to make the glove stick out with the fingers straight out in the air. And if you want to use the glove to grab something, you have to use a lot of force of your fingers to bend the inflated fingers of the glove. And in the process, your nails get dug up and they become bloody and removed from your fingernails get removed from your fingers, and the knuckles become bloodied. Each of the astronauts experienced that. That's just one of the many details of what it's like to live inside of a spacesuit. Let me drop this. I mean, while you're on Mars, yeah, you can envision tent there and you huddle inside that habitat. But boy, you're going to get cabin fever in a hurry. So to do any real exploration or planting plants or whatever, you're going to have to go outside. And you can only go outside with a spacesuit. And when you go into the details of how easily that spacesuit can get you into a lot of trouble if everything doesn't work just right. And living for any significant amount of time in a spacesuit is not pleasant. So, colonizing Mars. It's great to send a unmanned spacecraft there. Let it roam around, make measurements, and send the data back home. But what in the world is the advantage of putting a human being in that wicked environment when the chances of getting him back home in good health are so poor? And the cost to go to Mars. It took $33 billion on the Apollo program to go to the moon. And Mars is roughly 1,000 times further away than the moon. So roughly speaking, it's going to be 1,000 times more expensive. And that $33 billion was 1970 money. It's probably $100 billion today, and 1,000 times greater than that to go to Mars. Rough rule of thumb. Who in the world is going to pay for that? So, I think Roger has already told us to cross your name off the list of volunteers. Is that true, Roger? K2JAS, K2RIW.
K2JAS, yes, please. Don't mention my name. I think that money is much better spent on, well, a fraction of that money should be spent on robotic explorers. And the rest of the money spent on how we could better live on this planet, because abandoning this planet for others is going to be a horrendous expense. So I can envision us sending robots for mining purposes, for scientific purposes, for intellectual purposes. Not people. I think we have to get comfortable in our own skin on our own planet and start making things better. But I'm afraid I don't have too much confidence in that either. Back to you, Dick. K2JAS.
Yeah, from time to time, some very optimistic people say that we've got to find another place to go. Some other planet in our solar system. Because we may run into trouble with this planet. Well, I think we better treat this planet with tender, loving care. The chances of terraforming, the chances of taking some other planet in the solar system and converting it to being habitable, the chances of doing that are so slim. Every one of the planets that we know about are really a wicked place to go. You don't want to go there and dwell there. And a colony on Mars would have to be self-sustaining. You'd have to be doing farming. And to do farming on Mars is tremendously difficult. It has one-third the amount of sunlight you've got on Earth because it's further away from the sun. It's got no atmosphere, so you'd have to make a greenhouse that's pressurized. And those words roll off the tongue real easily. You try to make a pressurized greenhouse. I mean, a reasonable greenhouse has got a good fraction of an acre of glass to it in order to pass all the sunlight into the plants. And at 14 pounds per square inch, an acre of glass has got a zillion pounds of force you have to overcome. And if you say, well, I'm going to run the greenhouse at a much lower pressure, well, you run the plants at a much lower pressure, and the amount of photosynthesis they're going to do is a very small fraction. So you're cutting it down because of the amount of lack of sunlight. You're going to be cutting it down because of a lack of air pressure. There's a hell of a lot of details that we forget about. And mining operation. Let me drop it. Think of the most valuable stuff you can think of. Diamonds, platinum, uranium, gold, silver. No matter what you find on Mars, huge cost to get a spacecraft there and get the spacecraft back home. Means that no matter how valuable the stuff is, it's going to be worthless by the time you get it back. So people from time to time talk about mining an asteroid, mining the moon, and mining Mars. Not a chance. There's nothing there anywhere near valuable enough to support that. when it comes to the cost of getting the craft there and getting the mine stuff back home. You're better off mining the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. It'll be a hell of a lot cheaper. So, right now, essentially every single high school student in the United States, for sure, let me drop this. You interview any high school student, they're all dreaming about the fact that during their generation, they're positive, they're going to see some of their contemporaries walking the surface of Mars. They believe it's inevitable. My goodness, there's a hell of a lot of details telling me that that's very unlikely. Safety reasons and cost reasons, among others. And why do it? It's way beyond the cost that you can support with any one nation. You're going to have a group effort of a whole lot of nations to finance this operation to Mars. And a number of those nations are going to say, if I give you half of my gross domestic product to support this mission to Mars, what do I get in return for it? How do I justify this with my population? It sounds like a tough thing to sell. What do you think, Paul? Do you think you could sell it? WS2N, K2RAW?
Only if somebody's buying it, but there's plenty of people that are really involved with actually planning on going to Mars. You got NASA, you got the European Space Agency. There's all kinds of money involved with them that's trying to push some kind of development on the moon. And but as far as Mars goes, you have NASA that's building the SLS. Their ultimate plan is to go to Mars. Now they're paying Lockheed Martin to develop a habitat module that's going to be able to, first they want to test it out in moon orbit, but eventually they would like to send that off to Mars. That will be attached to the end of the Orion spacecraft. These are actual funding missions. They think it's going to take around 40 launches, environmental launches, testing this, testing that, around 40 launches of the SLS system to eventually get to the point where you're going to have enough infrastructure. That means it could be a space station in orbit around Mars. Infrastructure has to be completely developed before they'll send somebody down to the planet. That means stuff already on the planet, robotics. A lot of robotics involved doing that. Russia would like to get involved with us. They have a spaceport now called Voskhodny on the eastern end of Russia. Let me drop it. A little over a year ago, they launched their first rocket from Voskhodny. It was a Soyuz rocket. But their plans now are to develop this area. Now, it's only one rocket that's gone up. They have another launch coming up this November. But they're developing it for larger spacecraft. They have the Angara spacecraft, which they've already, the Angara rocket, which they've already tested, and it's already worked, that will eventually be launching from Voskhodny. Normally, their rockets launch from Plesk, the northern part of Russia, or from Kazakhstan, from Baikonur, which is they've been launching since 60 years ago when they put up Sputnik. By the way, Sputnik's 60th anniversary is coming up October 4th. But now they're planning on launching these heavy vehicles. They plan on sending deep space missions, you know, to the planet. This is the Russians, with or without the Americans. They want to get on board with the Americans. Scientists definitely do. Politically, it might be a little difficult, but right now we're working with them on a daily basis up on the International Space Station, so it's possible. My guess is probably with us, the Russians, and help of the European Space Agency. I think it might be possible. I'm going to still put a date on 2034. That's going to be my date for. Might be a little early, but I'm going to be optimistic about this. And this way, anybody that's listening, that's in high school, I think they might have a chance of seeing somebody in their generation walk on that planet by that year. Back to you, Dick.
So once again, how did you come to the conclusion of 2034?